Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring national security, power, and intelligence in the 21st century. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Professor Joseph Nye, author of The Future of Power. Also joining us today from IBM is Frank Strickland. Professor Nye, since the publication of your book, Bound to Lead, I'd like to understand how the state of global leadership has changed and what's the status of global leadership today?
Well, we always tend to think in our current era that there were giants in the past and that our leaders today are not up to the task. I don't think that that's, one could make lots of complaints about the quality of leaders today, but if one takes a longer historical perspective, one can see that there were some pretty poor leaders in the past. So I don't think there's a linear trend upward or downward.
In this century, how critical is it to think of shaping outcomes in terms of narrative, and to what extent does America need a new narrative in the shaping of the 21st century?
Well, the traditional American narrative of democracy and human rights and freedom is a pretty good narrative. Ronald Reagan realized this when he adapted the iconography of John Winthrop, the Puritan founder, and talked about a shining city on a hill. And in that sense, we can affect others by our example. And our narrative is not just what we say, it's also what we do. President George W. Bush had wonderful rhetoric about a freedom agenda in the 2005 inaugural address, but it was great for Americans. It wasn't great for the rest of the world because they thought it was inconsistent with our deeds. So a narrative is not just words. It's also an integration of words and deeds. And in that sense, I think as we do things, we have to ask not only what are we saying about what we're doing, but how consistent is what we're doing with our words and also with these deeper values.
When we talk about power transition from the West to East, you note that it really should be called the recovery or return of Asia. Why is becoming less dominant and coping with the rise of the rest not illustrative of a narrative of decline for nation states such as the U.S.?
Well, the trouble with the narrative of decline is that it confuses two different concepts. One is absolute decline. The other is relative decline. Absolute decline is what happened, for example, to ancient Rome, though it's also worth noticing it took 300 years to carry out the process. But Rome was an agricultural or agrarian society with basically static economic growth, and eventually succumbed to internecine warfare inside and to onslaughts of barbarians on the outside. It wasn't the rise of another empire or state. It was internal decay. I don't think that describes the U.S. We have lots of problems, but we also have one of the most competitive economies in the world. If you look at the rankings by the World Economic Forum or others, we're well ahead of other countries. And in terms of new technologies like biotechnology or nanotechnology, we're very much at the forefront. Almost all impartial surveys say American universities are leading the world and so forth. So this is not like ancient Rome. Whatever problems we have, it's not a good decline. Absolute decline is not a good metaphor. Relative decline may be more useful in the sense that if the rise of the rest means the gap between the U.S. and other countries, China, Brazil, India, and so forth, is narrower than it was, that can be portrayed as relative decline. But I think it's better to portray it as the rise of the rest, because even if the others reduce the gap between themselves and the United States, it's quite possible, indeed I think plausible, that the United States will remain ahead of them. So the gap may reduce, but the image of decline suggests that they pass us, and I think the answer is not. So the term is confusing. It confuses relative and absolute decline, and even on relative decline, it implies that others pass the U.S., whereas in fact, I think it's not likely.
If a return to traditional prudence must be part of a 21st century smart power narrative for America, how can American military primacy represent an economic asset and not a liability?
Well, it depends on what you spend your economic resources on. If we violate Eisenhower's wise advice of avoiding being involved in land wars of Asia, our military investments may turn out to be a tremendous drain. But if we think of American military role in Asia instead as keeping troops in Japan and South Korea, where the Japanese and the South Koreans helped to pay for a lot of them and where they're very, very welcome, then they're a net plus. So if you ask how does American military capability affect our overall position, for one thing, the other countries in Asia, Japan, India, Vietnam, South Korea, are concerned about the rise of China. They want the Americans there to help protect them, and that gives the United States a certain amount of power. So that's on the hard power side. The other thing is that military assets or military resources can sometimes produce soft power. So in 2004 and 5, when you had this terrible tsunami in Indonesia, the opinion of the United States in Indonesia was very low after the Iraq War. But after we used American naval resources to provide tsunami relief, there was a significant improvement in the attractiveness of the United States in Indonesia. I suspect that you'll see the same thing in the aftermath of the recent earthquake and tsunami and nuclear meltdown in Japan, that the Americans have been using military assets to provide massive humanitarian support. And I think that has probably helped to solidify the U.S.-Japan alliance.
Professor Nye, earlier in your book, The Future of Power, you referenced pragmatic or common sense realism. But later in the book, you call for a liberal realism. Would you explain the difference or similarities between these two concepts?
Well, for a long time, people have talked about liberalism and realism as though they're opposites. Very often, some realists have a rather mechanical view that it means the use of force and balance of power and nothing else. And some liberals have said, well, it means if you have more economic interdependence that you can avoid any conflicts. Both of those are simplistic and wrong. So when I talk of pragmatic realism, I mean a realism that starts with understanding balance of military power but doesn't stop there. And a good example of this is the way the United States designed its policies toward China and Asia in the Clinton administration. Looking at the situation in the 90s, as we were designing the East Asian Strategy Report of 94, 95, we realized there were three major powers in Asia, the U.S., Japan, and China. And China was increasing dramatically. At that time, some people said, well, the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty is a Cold War relic. Get rid of it. We said, no, on the contrary, the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty can be adapted and strengthened as a basis for stability in a post-Cold War period. And that essentially means that we could help to shape the environment in which Chinese power rises. Those if the U.S. and Japan stayed together, then in a three-party game, we were part of the two, not the one. And that's basic realism 101. But we went beyond that, and we said, let's now see if we can invite China to be a responsible participant in the international system, invite them into the World Trade Organization, accept their goods, their students. That's very different from Cold War containment, where we had very little trade and very few students from the Soviet Union. And that gives them incentives to essentially shape their behavior in a positive way as they grow. Now, how all this will turn out, we don't yet know. But it certainly is a design of a strategy which you might call liberal realism. Liberalism is the incentive for China to integrate into the world system and become what Bob Zelick later called a responsible stakeholder. And the realism part is the hedge. If China does instead become a bully, then essentially we're in a position to have a response which can help shape China away from that behavior.
Well, I'd like to turn to the future. What does the future hold for advancing the use of smart power? And in what ways do you see the organizational or operational structure of the U.S. government changing to accommodate this shift?
Well, I think we're going to have to learn to use the instruments of government in a more coordinated fashion. That means that state and defense are going to have to work very closely together but so will also Treasury and others be involved. I think it's something which is now widely agreed that a smart power strategy should do this, but it's much harder to implement. So, for example, Secretary of State Clinton added a QDDR, Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review, for the State Department to the Defense Department's QDR, Quadrennial Defense Review. That's indicating a planning for a broader purpose. But when it comes to actually getting state and defense to work together, even with lots of goodwill at the top, as there's been, there still are some of these cultural and bureaucratic barriers. For example, there was an aid program in defense, which was transferred to state, but when it was transferred, it was cut in half. So Clinton and Gates agreed to this transfer, but it was very hard to get Congress and OMB to keep it at the same level when it was transferred.
Right. Professor Nye, I want to thank you. Frank and I want to thank you for joining us today. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Well, it's a pleasure to have a chance to chat with you.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Professor Joseph Nye, University Distinguished Service Professor at Harvard University and author of The Future of Power. My co-host from IBM has been Frank Strickland. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.